This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, talk of criminal justice reform and an end to the war on drugs appears woefully insufficient. How are officials missing the point in their bid to finally consider addiction a public health crisis? Truthout editor-in-chief Maya Shenhar joins us to explain.
Also, we've all heard Hillary Clinton spend a lot of time praising George W. Bush for taking a compassionate approach to Muslims in the U.S. after 9/11. Well, that's not the entire story. And a case pending before the Supreme Court reveals the whole truth.
And folks, it's a time of the week that barely needs hyping up. It's Friday, so we'll be throwing someone in the garbage can today. And folks, I can tell you the odor of the can is already wafting into the studio. It's going to be a smelly one.
It is. I can hardly concentrate. It's so damn smelly in here.
Yeah.
Anyway, before we get to all of that, our garbage can duties.
Even smellier than usual.
Yeah, even a little smellier than normal. Before we get to that, since the last time we chatted, yesterday, wasn't that much time, really. Since then, several women have come forward alleging that Donald Trump sexually assaulted them. You know, this happens day to day to day. We get a new disturbing story about Donald Trump. Two accusations were published in the New York Times. One woman said Trump groped her breasts and attempted to put his hand up her skirt during a first-class flight to New York. This happened in the early 1980s. Another charge in the New York Times comes from a then 22-year-old receptionist who recalled meeting with Trump outside the Trump Tower elevators. She said Trump refused to let go of her hand after they shook, and that after they met, he proceeded to kiss her on the cheeks and then on the mouth without consent. Now, after the New York Times released this story with these two allegations, People magazine writer Natasha Stoyanov came forward offering her own allegation, saying that Trump forcibly kissed her in 2005 at his Mar-a-Lago resort. And then a fourth woman came forward and told the Palm Beach Post that the GOP nominee groped her 13 years ago also at his Mar-a-Lago resort. CBS News also has a report and video from a 1992 Entertainment Tonight Christmas feature at Trump Tower. Now, in this video, Trump flirts with 10-year-olds. Seriously, dude, 10-year-olds. Trump asks one of the girls in the video if she's, quote, going up the escalator. The girl replies, yeah, and Trump turns to the camera and says, I'm going to be dating her in 10 years. Can you believe it?
That is really... I've had older relatives who since have passed, you know, God rest their soul, RIP, but they used to make like lewd remarks, you know, about like, oh, kids meet your new grandmother and stuff, you know, like, well, it wasn't really that funny, but he would never, you know, never in my life would I have imagined anything like to a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Jesus.
10-year-olds, dude. 10-year-olds.
New ways to shock me this campaign and Donald Trump.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, your GOP nominee. These allegations come a day after it was reported that Trump routinely walked into the women's dressing rooms during beauty pageants, bragged about it, in fact, including during teen beauty pageants where women were as young as 14, just slightly older than 10. Still bad. They also come, these allegations, after that now infamous tape, in which Trump brags about how he can't help himself when he's around pretty women. He just has to kiss them. And how he brags how he can use his celebrity to get away with just kissing women and even groping them. Pretty much the exact stuff that Trump is now being accused of doing by these women who've stepped forward. Again, Trump is caught a few days ago on video. This is video from 2005 that was just released a few days ago. Trump is caught on video bragging about sexually abusing women. Women come forward and say, yes, they were sexually abused by Trump. So, not sure how Trump can deny it ever happened, considering he's already admitted to it. Well, Trump is denying it. Here he was on the campaign trail, rejecting the press reports at a rally in Florida on Thursday.
Claims are all fabricated. They're pure fiction and they're outright lies. These events never, ever happened, and the people that said them meekly fully understand. You take a look at these people, you study these people, and you'll understand also. The claims are preposterous, ludicrous, and defy truth, common sense, and logic. We already have substantial evidence to dispute these lies, and it will be made public in an appropriate way.
He also says, and in an appropriate time, which would presumably be now, but I have a feeling we're not going to see this evidence dumped. The Trump campaign sent a letter. Again, Trump is denying these accusations, and these accusations are pretty much exactly what he was bragging that he did. In a 2005 audio tape.
It's like his MO.
Yeah. Trump campaign sent a letter to the New York Times demanding a retraction of the story. Trump's attorneys claimed in the letter that the report was, quote, reckless, defamatory, and constitutes libel. They threatened to pursue, quote, all available actions and remedies if the newspaper refused to retract the story and apologize. Well, the New York Times isn't budging. They're not retracting the story. They're not apologizing. They're basically like, well, see you in court. Here's what the New York Times said in its letter in response to Trump, reading from it right now. The essence of a libel claim, of course, is the protection of one's reputation. Mr. Trump has bragged about this non-consensual sexual touching of women. He has bragged about intruding on beauty pageant contestants in their dressing rooms. He acquiesced to a radio host's request to discuss Mr. Trump's own daughter as a piece of ass. Multiple women not mentioned in our article have come forward publicly to report on Mr. Trump's unwanted advances. Nothing in our article has had the slightest effect on the reputation that Mr. Trump, through his own words and actions, has already created for himself.
Get him.
That was an own. The Times added that they would, quote, welcome the opportunity to have a court set him straight. Something tells me Trump won't want to proceed with a lawsuit, which will then lead to discovery, and we'll get more information as to whether or not these allegations are actually true. I tend to believe them. And that whole plan that Trump had, by the way, after the tapes came out over the weekend, of deflecting attention from that tape by focusing on accusations against Bill Clinton, I don't think that's going to work anymore either, since he has just as many women lined up against him now, too.
Yeah, he's got a whole bunch full of women.
Yeah. So that's what's going on the campaign trail. Here's what's going on off it. First, some news for a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
War in Yemen, folks. Yeah, we've drone bombed the country in the past. And yes, we've supplied weapons and refueling missions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which has been conducting a brutal air assault in Yemen, killing thousands of civilians in their bid to crush Houthi rebels, which Saudi Arabia claims is aligned with the Iranian government. But now the U.S. is involved in directly lobbing bombs onto Houthi rebel targets. U.S. warships late Wednesday fired missiles at Houthi positions, marking the first time that American forces have directly involved in the ongoing fighting over there. American government officials claim that the attacks hit and destroyed three radar installations. According to NPR, strikes were launched in retaliation after two missiles were launched from Yemen at a U.S. destroyer in 4 days. Houthi forces, via state media organs they control, denied responsibility for those attacks. But, folks, this is what mission creep looks like here. Providing refueling missions, providing arms, providing intelligence, to now directly carrying out military strikes in this conflict in Yemen. And it could be just the start of further U.S. escalation in the region. Also, this is a story from earlier in the week. We haven't had a chance to talk about it on the show yet, given all the assaulting Trump has reportedly been doing. we've all heard in recent weeks Hillary Clinton praise George W. Bush, praise other Republicans for their outreach toward Muslims following 9/11. She repeats the claim in a bid to peel off Republican voters from Trump, who she would argue is a unique monster in the GOP. In fact, to give you an example of this, Clinton tweeted in August, quote, "The week after 9/11, George W. Bush went to a mosque and declared for everyone to hear that Muslims love America just as much as I do." Well, this praise of Bush doesn't tell the full story of how his administration treated Muslims after 9/11. It's a case set to be pending before the Supreme Court clearly illustrates. Supreme Court announced this week that it will hear litigation that will determine if high-ranking U.S. officials can be sued for civil rights abuses that occurred just after the 9/11 attacks. The case was brought by mostly Muslim immigrants against former top George W. Bush appointees. They include Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller. Hundreds of plaintiffs allege that they were swept up in an immigration dragnet in Brooklyn just after the 2001 attacks. They accused the government of overseeing beatings, administering strip searches, and placing them in solitary confinement for long stretches. And this is all something that the Justice Department's Inspector General has confirmed in 2003. As then Inspector General Glenn Fine testified before Congress that year in 2003, quote, "Detainees were placed in restraints whenever they were moved, including handcuffs, leg irons, and heavy chains." Reading directly now from what Fine said, quote, "The evidence indicates a pattern of physical and verbal abuse by some correctional officers at the MDC against some September 11th detainees. This generally consisted of slamming some detainees into walls, dragging them by their arms, stepping on the chains between their ankles, cuffs, twisting their arms, hands, wrists, and fingers, and making slurs and threats such as 'you will feel pain and you are going to die here.'" Most of these detainees described were Muslims, and they were brought in on minor visa violations. And a lot of these people have since been deported. A federal appeals court in New York had stripped Ashcroft and Mueller of their qualified immunity last year.
Quick point on that. Likely because of that decision, it looks like, based on that and precedent, that the Supreme Court will overturn, that they've taken up this case to overturn that federal appellate decision. There was a similar case in 2011. It was brought against John Ashcroft. And yeah, they dismissed it.
Oh, well. Before we close this segment out, a word on cyber hacking and who or what might actually be a beneficiary of cyberspace anxieties. And no, I'm not talking about cybersecurity contractors, people who are getting very rich
including former House Intelligence Chairman Mike Rogers,
yeah,
right? Isn't he in the CyberSec contracting game?
He's in some sort of game, but he's working as some sort of advisor or something. But I do recall we wrote a story like a year ago about shortly after he retired, he was hawking cybersecurity insurance for companies to purchase cybersecurity insurance, which I didn't even know existed at the time, but not surprised at all by it.
Yeah, I wonder if the Clinton campaign bought some. Probably not.
And even if they did, I don't think anything
matters.
It
doesn't matter. How can you insure against that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But back to this story. A beneficiary of cyber hacking could actually be the U.S. Postal Service. The Government Accountability Office analyzed how the internet is reducing Americans' reliance on the good old post office and suggested that the downward trend of paper mail delivery may only be temporary. Postal experts interviewed by the GAO claimed that the continued electronic diversion in mail delivery, jargon for people switching from using paper mail to pay bills and communicate with their friends to then just using the internet to pay bills, well, these experts said that that's going to be short-lived as more people get burned in cyberspace. Here's what the GAO said, quote, "Internet privacy and security concerns could be contributing to a slowed rate of electronic diversion. The oversight agency also pointed to meetings with business officials who said their area customers believe that the USPS, the post office, is safer to use because of, quote, computer hacking and identity theft concerns associated with online transactions. Now, over the last decade, the USPS has seen mail decline by 28%. Carriers delivered roughly 60 billion fewer pieces of mail in 2015 than they did in 2006, and those declines have primarily been attributed to the proliferation of broadband, of the internet. More people pay their bills online, correspond via email instead of letters. As a result, first-class mail or stamped letters has declined by half over the last 9 years. And although the post office has seen an uptake in package deliveries as more people shop online and have goods sent to them at home, those increases have not been enough to set off the disappearing demand for first-class mail. Now, while four of the 11 postal experts reviewed by GAO cited online privacy and security as a force that could resurrect traditional mail delivery, get people off relying on the internet and relying just on good old paper mail again, other experts reviewed by GAO were more pessimistic about the future of the post office, and they actually saw increased electronic diversion in the future. For example, GAO cited two officials who warned that there will be another precipitous decline in first-class mail as younger generations, who have come of age almost entirely using electronic services and technologies for their business and personal interactions, grow to become the dominant portion of the population and economy. Honestly, I think that that is probably the more likely scenario when it comes to the mail than the prior explanation. Even as people get hacked and are uncomfortable online, they still prefer the convenience of being able to just pay their bills with a few clicks online rather than send in mail.
Yeah, plus if you have a mailbox instead of a slot, someone can just walk up and steal your letters.
Yeah, and increasing anxiety that maybe your privacy is being violated when you use regular mail as well. We reported on the Sentinel a few weeks ago about how Senator Ron Wyden has written a letter to the U.S. Postmaster General about a surveillance program run out of the post office that basically captures pictures of every piece of mail and hands over metadata to police without a warrant. So the post office needs a lot of help. I don't think the cyber hackers are going to be their best bet. More unanimous dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C.
Well, it's easy to forget that criminal justice reform has been at the forefront of the nation's agenda in recent years, with the Republican presidential candidate openly calling for America's already militarized police state to be given even more of a carte blanche. But indeed, we have seen a notable shift in attitudes in Washington toward criminal justice and the war on drugs. Just recently, for example, the DEA said it would delay its ban of the herbal opiate substitute Kratom, which was supposed to start 2 weeks ago. A Schedule 1 determination would see the prohibition of a substance that many claim is a safe substitute for Schedule 2 prescription pain meds that cause tens of thousands of fatal overdoses annually. Now advocates will have time to persuade the DEA to not pursue Schedule 1 determination for Kratom. But of course, the war on drugs writ large isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And even the country's more humane approach to addicted users is fraught with pitfalls and nasty authoritarian streaks. Joining us now to discuss this subject is someone who wrote a great column recently highlighting the problem. Maya Shinwar is the editor-in-chief of truthout.org, which, full disclosure, syndicates some of our written work over at districtsentinel.com. Maya is also the author of Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prisons Don't Work and How We Can Do Better. And you can follow her on Twitter at Maya Shinwar. Welcome, Maya.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
Thanks for coming on. So right off the bat, you pulled out something in your latest Truth Out column that kind of startled me, although I suppose I shouldn't be that surprised. A U.S. representative has called on certain types of drug dealers to face the death penalty. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of an extreme example of the type of thing we're seeing all over the country in relation to opiates in particular, because opiates and particularly heroin and a drug called fentanyl are seen as a substance that is causing a crisis right now. So there's a lot of alarmism going on, along with just the fact that there are a lot of overdoses happening, or there's been an increase in overdoses. And so a lot of politicians are really seizing on that crisis to put forward, I guess, what would have been referred to and what Donald Trump would refer to in a positive sense as law and order policies. And one of those policies, this New York Congressman Tom Reed put forward, was legislation. It's strangely enough, it's called the HELP Act, and it's intended to make it possible to sentence someone to the death penalty if they have sold a type of heroin that has led to an overdose. And this, so it would be one thing if this guy were just way out of left field and he's just one dude with some strange ideas, but actually all over the country, we are seeing states dusting off old laws, you know, from kind of the heyday of the drug war, that allow murder charges for selling drugs that later result in an overdose. This is happening in a number of different states. And also prosecutors are beefing up drug charges to make it possible to charge people with murder.
So what are some examples of these? In which states, where's this occurring and what is being proposed?
So one way that this is happening is some states like New Jersey, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Louisiana, a number of states already have laws on the books that allow charges to be brought for murder for people who sell drugs that result in overdoses. And those laws just haven't been used because they're so extreme. And they were kind of just laws that passed during the fervor of the height of the drug war, when it was just okay to pass anything as long as it was anti-drug. So these states are now dusting off those laws and actually putting them into practice and charging people with various murder charges. And then there's also kind of this discussion happening around sentencing. So the death penalty, that was this proposal in New York. In West Virginia, they're discussing permitting life incarceration, so basically dying behind bars, to be imposed for selling heroin. And then all over the place, we're seeing federal prosecutors adding charges and kind of beefing up charges. So that's something prosecutors can do. They decide what to charge people with. And so we're seeing them beefing up charges in case of overdose. So they're not just charging people with selling drugs. They're charging people for causing physical harm or causing death. So there's a wide range of ways that we are seeing this play out.
You quote one Ohio lawmaker who said that, quote, jail is for the traffickers, treatment is for the addicts. A lot of this is being billed as a more humane way that we're going to target the dealers and the traffickers and not the addicts. But as you mentioned in your article, such statements ignore the fact that those two categories often overlap, and that even people only convicted of possession still sometimes end up in prison. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's this idea when people talk about traffickers or dealers, people have this image of this kingpin like sitting on piles of gold. And it just couldn't be further from the case. Most people who sell drugs are not doing it because it's their first choice of career. Most of the time, they're poor working class people, people who don't necessarily have a lot of other options for how to make money or how to make steady money for their families. They're also often people who use drugs themselves. So there's not this kind of like perpetrator-victim relationship between people who sell drugs and people who use them. And I think when you put it in those terms of kind of perpetrator, victim, it seems a whole lot nicer to say, okay, well, these are the people who should be punished. And so I think that, yeah, people really like when they're pushing for these hardline policies to divide people into these stark categories of dealer and user. And then the other thing that we're seeing on that front is kind of a push to see users as kind of helpless victims. And I think that's particularly true in the opiate crisis, because the vast majority of people dying of overdoses in this particular realm are white. And so there's been this push to portray people dying of overdoses as white, and then to portray dealers in particular as black, which is not true. Actually, most people who sell drugs are white, but that's kind of another trend in the media coverage and among politicians.
It's almost as if lawmakers, at least in their own minds, when they're writing these laws, see every drug dealer as like kind of a Scarface figure.
Yes.
But they're not.
Well, a black Scarface figure.
Yeah, black Scarface, I was going to say.
I think it's Maine's Governor LePage who's the worst at that, pretty much, at that sort of rhetoric.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Sam, because I wanted to ask Maya about that. Governor LePage perhaps has the most reactionary outlook of all 50 state governors. And a lot of people, he's getting a lot of attention because people who are wondering what a Donald Trump presidency would look like can look to Governor LePage. And
who just recently praised Trump for his authoritarianism and how we could use Trump's authoritarianism.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. So Maya, I was wondering if you could enlighten our listeners about some of Governor LePage's views on the state of the drug war.
Sure. Yeah, Governor LePage is unique, not in the fact that he advocates for racist drug policy, but that he's just so overt about the fact that he is racist and that his policies are racist.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of interesting. Like, he's made these statements throughout the past year where he has explicitly said, like, drug dealers are black people, you know, portrayed in all kinds of different terms. And they're coming up from New York and they are selling heroin to young white girls in particular. So he's drawing that really dangerous kind of like predatory line, which we know that myth, you know, very well throughout US history.
Yeah.
Where, you know,
the innocence of young white girls being corrupted by nefarious non-white people.
Exactly.
Is a constant stream throughout U.S. history.
Right. And so in this case, and I think this is appealing to a lot of white people in Maine who are seeing their friends and loved ones and children using heroin and struggling with heroin. It's very appealing to think that this was a result of just like a blatant crime of some perpetrator coming along, someone that they can racialize as black and say, okay, it's this person's fault. And so that's what he's doing. So he's also kind of on the treatment bandwagon. It's a strange thing. We see all of these conservative politicians saying, yes, we need treatment. And also, we need to punish a certain group of people much, much harder. And so that's the type of thing LePage is advocating. And he actually made this statement not that long ago, kind of defending his position and his racist ways. And he was like, well, you know, most of the people, I think he said 90% of the people arrested for selling drugs in Maine are black or Latino. And what's perhaps interesting about that is he might be telling the truth.
Yeah,
90% high. But it's like, we have to remember that drug arrests do not correspond to the population who's actually selling drugs. It's just that, especially when you have really racist people in power, black and brown people are the ones getting arrested.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You also mentioned in your article, a lot of these drug laws are billed as a way to keep people safe, as a public safety measure. And yet, just the act of making drugs illegal makes it more dangerous for individuals to use those drugs, as you point out in your article. How so?
So criminalization has been shown to make people less likely to seek treatment, and not only treatment. So even if someone doesn't want to recover, like they want to continue using drugs, they're more likely to use in harmful ways if it's criminalized, because there's all this stigma attached. They're more likely to try to use quickly. They're more likely to hide their use. And they're more likely to take all these steps so that other people don't know they're using. And that's true even when someone is facing health problems. They're a lot less likely to go to the hospital, to call 911, all of these things, because when a drug is criminalized in any way, seeking help is often putting yourself in danger of incarceration or in danger of some sort of punishment via the criminal legal system.
I wanted to broaden the scope a little bit, and something that has been the subject of discussion among reform-minded people is that the true root of America's mass incarceration problem is not so much drug laws themselves, though they're part of the problem, mm-hmm. but long sentences for all crimes, including violent offenses, which might make some reform-minded people uncomfortable. I was wondering what your thoughts on this are as someone who's written a lot about criminal justice reform and the prison system.
Yeah. So I think that one thing that has been unfortunately pretty consistent throughout mainstream reform efforts is that everyone says, okay, we need to really reduce sentences and reduce criminalization among nonviolent offenders. The buzzword is first-time nonviolent offenders, like trying to find the people in prison who are innocent. And actually, when Obama did his big famous speech from a federal prison last year, he said, there are some people in prison who are here for small things, and they're kind of just like you and me, I'm paraphrasing, something like that. And then he said, and then there are the violent criminals who should be in prison. And so that's the line that's just been enforced and enforced. And really, you're talking about, you know, half and sometimes more than half in men's prisons, the population of prisons. And so you can't end mass incarceration without addressing violent offenses and addressing those corresponding sentences. And one thing that has been brought up recently that I think is really interesting, there's a campaign in New York and there are some other campaigns around the country that are looking specifically to release aging people in prison, and pointing to the fact that most aging people in prison, like most people who've been in prison for many years, they're 60, 70, 80, 90, they've been there for a long time because they were convicted of a violent offense. Hmm. Well, guess what? Like, the thing that makes you most likely to commit a violent offense is being young. Most people, you know, as they age, are much, 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 much less likely to commit a violent offense. And so there are a number of campaigns right now, and I think this is a really hopeful thing that's happening, which are advocating for people to be released earlier, both releasing people on parole, releasing people through compassionate release, and also just shortening sentences. Because, you know, even if you abide by the system's logic, the people who are least likely to offend after prison, so the least likely people to commit another crime, are people convicted of first degree murder. So I think we really have to reconfigure the way that we think about and process violent crime in our heads. And then we need to put those thoughts into action and think of creative ways to advocate for changes to these policies.
Absolutely. Maya Shenwar, the editor-in-chief at truthout.org. You can follow her on Twitter at Maya Shenwar. Thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you, Maya.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. It's Friday, which means it's time to throw someone in the dang garbage can, but before we do that...
It's like the inverse garbage can here.
Yeah, we need to toss out a few apologies. First, an apology to Evan McMullen, the guy who's running for president. We've frequently belittled him on the show, including by regularly calling him Egg McMuffin. We've characterized his presidential run as a pathetic joke. But now we're not so sure.
Yeah, there are some doubts.
Recent polling out of the state of Utah shows McMullen is in a dead heat with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to win the state. The poll by Y2 Analytics earlier this week has Clinton and Trump tied at 26%, with McMullen, he's a graduate of BYU, by the way, at 22%. He's actually competitive in this race. He may actually... win Utah. He could pick up electoral votes in this election.
Yeah.
I mean, given Donald Trump's tailspin, I'm not even sure Donald Trump might pick up an electoral vote at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Wouldn't that be? Oh, man.
Yeah. But here's McMullen picking up votes, maybe. So clearly we wrote this guy off too early. And for that, we apologize. So Mr. Egg McMuffin, Mr. Evan McMullen, we're sorry. Good luck screwing Trump in Utah.
Also, if I may, an apology to Peter Dow of the pro-Clinton campaign website, Blue Nation Review.
What the hell could we be possibly apologizing to Peter Dow about?
Yeah, this is a bit of a circuitous one. A lot of explanations, so I'll try to get through this quick. So in a previous edition of The Garbage Can, I inveighed against the New York Times for profiling Dow and portraying him as some sort of grassroots media wizard instead of the hack that he is.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, I was definitely red and nude about the fact that the Times weren't prodding connections between Dow and the campaign itself.
I don't remember you being nude at the time, but go on.
Well, nude and red, you know, the online. Okay. Proverb. It's a proverb. Okay. It's an ancient proverb. He who shall be nude and red shall always be alone in bed. that wasn't so bad from being on this spot.
Not so bad at all.
Anyway.
Our engineers are applauding you.
So anyway, thanks to WikiLeaks, we know now at least that the Clinton campaign wants some breathing room. They want some space. They need their space.
Who can blame them?
So in one of the emails from John Podesta's computer that was obtained by WikiLeaks, the Clinton campaign discussed Dow and set out their engagement strategy. A message forwarded to Podesta in August 2015 highlighted what was then the brainchild of Dow and a guy named Tom Watson.
Not to be confused with the golfer.
No, and I'm also blocked on Twitter by Tom Watson. Anyway, their website...
The golfer?
No. Nice, nice. Their website was called www.hillarymin.com. And sort of like the New York Times, the message kind of assumes the project is organic and grassroots and urges the Clinton campaign to work with Dow and Watson. Thoughts? Podesta asks and forwards it to the other campaign people. I agree these guys are doing great work and we are in touch with them, Teddy Goff replied. He's one of the Clinton people. In addition to our regular outreach, we are organizing a few digital influencer summits, some in person, some conference calls in the coming weeks, and plan to invite them. They plan to invite Peter and Tom. So, you know, this kind of seems like coordination between the campaign and a, quote, independent group, one whose co-leader has gone on to work for Blue Nation Review, which was set up by a guy who leads the pro-Hillary super PAC, Correct the Record, a.k.a. David Brock, another ostensibly independent group. So, you know, is something sketchy going on here? Is there some close coordination? not so fast. So Goff continues. One thing you have to be aware of, if you aren't already, is that Peter worked on 08 and apparently burned a lot of bridges. I don't know the whole story, but digital folks from that campaign do not speak highly of him. However, Goff added, I believe WJC is a fan, though. Possibly a reference to William Jefferson Clinton. So, Peter Dow, you have at least one guy in your corner. Lol, congratulations. Following up, Jennifer Palmieri, the Clinton campaign comms director, chimes in, telling Podesta et al. About, again, Peter Dow and Tom Watson. Yeah, they are a little off.
The understatement of the year.
So, sorry to Peter. It turns out that whatever is going on between you and the Clinton team, well, they only want so much of it. So it turns out we may have overstated the extent to which you are, in fact, the agent of AstroTurfers.
But we are going to keep you in the garbage can.
Yeah. And on that note, on to the can.
All right. Yeah. Just put it in the corner over there.
That's right.
Okay. Go ahead and remove the lid. Remove the lid. Okay. Oh man. It is stinky.
Wow.
It certainly is stinky. All right. I can't deal with the smell. Let's get through this as soon as we can.
The workers have to get out of there for their own safety.
Yes. Please leave. We will handle it from here.
Yeah. Well,
we will handle it from here.
All right. Okay. Let's go. Hurry up.
Garbage candidate number one. Presidential Debate Commission and the moderators of those debates so far. Fox News' Chris Wallace will be moderating the third and final debate next week, and he's unveiled the topics. They include immigration, debt and entitlements, the Supreme Court, foreign hotspots, and the candidate's fitness to be president. What there won't be a discussion about is the biggest threat to mankind, climate change. In fact, there hasn't been a question devoted to climate change in any of the debates so far, not any of the two presidential debates or the vice presidential debate. Candidates have even barely mentioned the issue. Adam Johnson, reporter over at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, noted on Twitter that he calculated the number of mentions per topic in each of the first three debates. So far, Russia and Putin have gotten 137 mentions by the candidates. ISIS and terrorism have gotten 101 mentions. Meanwhile, abortion? That's only got 6 mentions. LGBT rights? That's only gotten 3 mentions, and one of those references was just to bash Russia. And climate change? Climate change has only gotten 3 mentions. So Putin and Russia have gotten 137 mentions in these debates. Climate change, the biggest threat facing mankind, only 3 mentions. So for ignoring that issue for pretty much the entire general election debate season, the commission and its moderators have been nominated to organize a debate among each other in the garbage can.
Moving on now to garbage candidate number 2, John Chait.
Perennial all-star.
Yeah, got the heavy hitters out today. On Thursday, as the country grappled with the flood of women who stepped forward to accuse Donald Trump of sexual assault, Chait wanted to make sure that his Twitter followers don't forget all the victims, namely himself. You're now reading from his tweet. The locker room line has made me feel personal discomfort. Feeling like women look at me and assume I've been a part of that kind of convo, Chait tweeted as First Lady Michelle Obama railed against Trump at a Clinton campaign event.
Aw.
Poor thing, John. All this talk about sexual assault must be really hard on you. One of the good ones.
Riding in on his horse.
Yeah. So this was picked up by freelance tech reporter Maya Kosoff. Apologies, Maya, if I'm mispronouncing your last name. Anyway, Maya quote tweeted John saying, yes, truly men are the real victims of objectification and sexual assault. Burn. Chait, however... not one to let someone get the last word, replied with a quote tweet of his own. Aw, awful left-wing Twitter objects because one tweet about personal discomfort dishonors the real victims.
Keep digging,
yeah,
John.
Yeah, notice how he's again bemoaning that his nobility and his chivalry are legitimate collateral damage in all of this.
Yeah.
That is great. That's great. But, seriously though, John, you've suffered a lot this week. Our thoughts and prayers are with John Chait at this difficult time, this difficult personal time. But of course, those thoughts and prayers, those thoughts and those prayers are of perhaps seeing him at the end of this segment in the garbage can.
Yeah, he can bring his horse too. Garbage candidate number three, Joe Scarborough, from one end of the spectrum to the other, from John Chait's white knighting to Joe Scarborough's sexual assault apologia on his morning MSNBC show, Morning Joe. On Thursday, Joe expressed skepticism about the latest accusations lodged by women against Donald Trump. Believe women? Not so much for Joe Scarborough. He was careful to say that he's not skeptical of the women's stories, just the timing of it all. Here's what he said, quote, "I'm skeptical about the timing of all of this. Talk about an October surprise when, again, as you said, there have been 1,000 triggering events that would have made sense. If I had been sexually harassed by this man," think about that for a sec, "the Megyn Kelly story would have given me an opportunity. There have been 1,000 of these reports already. I'm just asking why suddenly all of this is blowing up in October." Well, I don't know. Joe could listen to what these women have specifically said themselves, which is that they came forward after the audio tape was released last weekend of Trump bragging about sexual assaults, and then after Trump at the debate denied that he ever did any of this stuff. That's what has motivated a lot of these women. And the reason why women don't initially come forward, as Scarborough claims, is because it's really freaking hard to do that. It's painful. It's embarrassing. And especially when you're going up against someone powerful like Donald Trump, it could ruin your life. We played a clip at the beginning of the show of what Donald Trump said, basically making threats of information he's going to reveal about these accusers. But Scarborough doesn't understand any of this, apparently. And for him to say if he had been sexually harassed by Trump, he would have come forward sooner, shows just how clueless he is. And for that, old Joe might end up in the old garbage can.
Wow, yeah, that's Chait. I don't know if Chait's going to beat that.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on, we'll get to that later, because now it's time for garbage candidate number four. You might know him as the governor of New Jersey, one Christopher Christie.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Is his first name actually Christopher?
I don't know.
Some people, you know, they don't have the... Anyway, Chris Christie.
Maybe he can present his birth certificate for us.
Oh. Anyway, as we have noted before on this show, Chris Christie swears that he didn't close the bridge. He knew nothing about it. He knew nothing about the bridge. In late 2013, for example, when the story broke about the lane closures on the George Washington Bridge, Governor Christie made a self-righteous joke about it. "I was the guy out there in overalls and a hat. I actually was the guy working the cones out there," he told a reporter. "You really are not serious with that question." Well, it turns out that not only was that question serious, we all know by now, it could get litigated in court amid a separate federal trial in which two former Christie aides are facing conspiracy charges related to the incident. A Bergen County judge allowed a criminal complaint to proceed against the governor for the bridge closure. The filing was made by a retired firefighter named William Brennan. William Brennan, where's that name sound from? Oh, no, I'm thinking of John Brennan.
Yeah. Maybe they're related.
Maybe. Anyway, William Brennan, not the head of the CIA, a retired firefighter who said, according to the New York Times, that evidence for the complaint came out when a former Christie aide, quote, testified that Mr. Christie was told about the shutdown 3 days after they began during a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. That aide was David Wildstein. He's already pleaded guilty to charges related to the conspiracy. Now, Christie might not ever face charges. Bergen County prosecutors need to first choose to seek an indictment. But the fact that a judge has allowed the complaint to proceed shows how far from grace Christie has fallen. And it is a plunge that this week might take him into the garbage can.
Yes, it might. And before we move on to our final candidate, garbage candidate number five, I just want to... It's always been known that Christie had something to do with Bridgegate. It was like,
yeah.
Everyone's just like, obviously you did this. It's just a matter of time before evidence comes out and this is all revealed.
Yeah.
And my favorite part of all this was during the GOP primary.
Trump.
Yeah. Like, Trump had refrained from attacking Chris Christie the whole time. We know now that, like, Chris Christie would later jump aboard Trump's campaign and everything. But the moment that Trump finally decided to start attacking Chris Christie, he decided to use the Bridgegate. And he simply said, all right, you know, I didn't want to do this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to attack Chris Christie. You ready for it? You ready?
He knew about the bridge.
He knew about the bridge.
Yeah.
Come on, folks. He knew about the bridge. He knew about the bridge. Like, all of us were just like, yeah, obviously, he knew about the bridge. Okay, garbage candidate number five, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. Got to be honest with you, it's been a while since I've even thought about Michelle Bachmann. Not since her 2012 presidential run.
I thought about her recently. I'll just say this, because some hack on Twitter, or not even on Twitter, it was like some Guardian column was like, can you imagine if Donald Trump was a man? You can't. It's impossible. If it was a woman could never be Donald Trump. And people were like quote tweeting and like, yeah, Michelle Bachmann gave up. Like, yeah, immediately.
And there was a time in 2012 where Michelle Bachmann was ahead in the polls.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody just assumed this year that Donald Trump would be like Michelle Bachmann and be ahead around the time of the Ohio or Iowa straw poll and then fall off. But that never happened. Anyways, Michelle Bachmann, here she is popping back up again to say something that really has you scratching your head and wondering how anyone could have casted a vote for this lunatic politician in the first place. In an interview with the American Pastors Network, which is a thing, something I'm going to quickly add to my podcast queue here. In an interview, Bachmann said that liberals were using Trump's lewd, crude remarks to encourage Christian women to vote for Hillary Clinton, which is true, as you'd expect them to do, take advantage of these crude remarks to encourage voters not to support him. Anyway, Bachmann then claimed, however, that a Clinton presidency would be even worse for women than a Trump presidency. Yes, even worse than the guy who brags about sexually assaulting women. Here's what Bachmann said, quote, I believe that Hillary Clinton will set a standard in this country that will lead to more sexual assaults against women because she will be setting an anti-biblical agenda.
Oh.
Last time I checked, the Bible wasn't too keen on protecting women from assault and treating them as sexual equals. Look, it's one thing to be a hyper-religious zealot, that's fine, but you can't be both. You can't be a Trump supporter and a hyper-religious zealot. It just doesn't make sense. But Michelle Bachmann, as a human being, has never really made sense. In fact, the only sense she could possibly make is by digging it up out of the garbage can to which she has just been nominated. All right, those are your contenders. Michelle Bachmann, real quick, we're out of time. Michelle Bachmann, we've got the presidential debate commissions and the moderators.
Stop. It's Joe Scarborough.
Joe Scarborough.
Right off the bat. Yeah, what he said was just too bad.
It was extremely bad.
We can't not throw Joe in.
Yeah.
All right, ready? Joe
Scarborough. You are going in the garbage can. Enjoy your cup of morning Joe in the can, my man.
Oh, my man just leaned in to the can. Or sorry, leaned forward. That's the MSNBC thing.
You're gonna miss Mika in there. She's not in the can yet. You're there by yourself, Joe. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Search for the show and subscribe to it on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for next week's show. Sam is running around the room. He's happy the weekend is here. We're not going anywhere, though. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.